Prax gunned the scooter, sliding fast down the ramp. The chatter of automatic weapons and the smell of smoke and steam melt followed him. The school's doors were closed. He didn't know if that was ominous or hopeful. He brought the wobbling scooter to a halt, jumped off. His legs felt weak and unsteady. He meant to knock gently on the steel drop door, but his first try split the skin over his knuckle. "Open up! My daughter's in there!" He sounded like a madman. But someone inside heard him or saw him on the security monitor. The articulated steel plates of the door shuddered and began to rise. Prax dropped to the ground and scrambled through. He hadn't met the new teacher, Miss Carey, more than a few times when dropping May off or picking her up. She couldn't have been more than 20 years old and was belter tall and thin. He didn't remember her face being so gray. The schoolroom was intact, though. The children were in a circle, singing a song about an ant traveling through the solar system with rhymes for all the major asteroid bodies. There was no blood, no bullet holes, but the smell of burning plastic was seeping through the vents. He had to get May someplace safe. He wasn't sure where that would be. He looked at the circle of children, trying to pick out her face, her hair. "May's not here, sir," Miss Carey said, her voice tight and breathy at the same time. "Her mother got her this morning." "This morning?" Prax said, but his mind fastened on her mother. What was Nicola doing on Ganymede? He'd had a message from her 2 days earlier about the child support judgment. She couldn't have gotten from Ceres to Ganymede in 2 days. "Just after snack," the teacher said.
"You mean she was evacuated? Someone came and evacuated May?"
Another explosion came, shaking the ice. One of the children made a high, frightened sound. The teacher looked from him to the child, then back. When she spoke again, her voice was lower. "Her mother came just after snack. She took May with her. She hasn't been here all day." Prax pulled up his hand terminal. The connection was still dead, but his wallpaper was a picture from May's first birthday, back when things were still good, lifetimes ago. He held up the picture and pointed at Nicola, laughing and dangling the doughy, delighted bundle that had been May. "Her?" Prax said. "She was here?" The confusion in the teacher's face answered him. There'd been a mistake. Someone, a new nanny or a social worker or something, had come to pick up a kid and gotten the wrong one. "She was on the computer," the teacher said. "She was in the system. It showed her." The lights flickered. The smell of smoke was getting stronger, and the air recyclers were humming loudly, popping and crackling as they struggled to suck out the volatile particulates. A boy whose name Prax should have known whimpered, and the teacher reflexively tried to turn toward him. Prax took her elbow and wrenched her back. "No, you made a mistake," he said. "Who did you give May to?" "The system said it was her mother. She had identification. It cleared her." A stutter of muted gunfire came from the hallway. Someone was screaming outside, and then the kids started to shriek. The teacher pulled her arm away. Something banged against the drop door. "She was about 30, dark hair, dark eyes. She had a doctor with her. She was in the system, and May didn't make any kind of fuss about it."
"Did they take her medicine?" he asked. "Did they take her medicine?"
"No, I don't know, I don't think so." Without meaning to, Prax shook the woman. Only once, but hard. If May didn't have her medicine, she'd already missed her midday dose. She might make it as long as morning before her immune system started shutting down.
"Show me," Prax said. "Show me the picture, the woman who took her."
"I can't, the system's down," the teacher shouted. "They're killing people in the hallway." The circle of children dissolved, screams riding on the backs of screams. The teacher was crying, her hands pressed to her face. Her skin had an almost blue cast to it. He could feel the raw animal panic leaping through his brain. The calm that fell on him didn't take away from it. "Is there an evacuation tunnel?" he asked. "They told us to stay here," the teacher said. "I'm telling you to evacuate," Prax said. But what he thought was, "I have to find May." Chapter 4. Bobby. Consciousness returned as an angry buzzing noise and pain. Bobby blinked once, trying to clear her head, trying to see where she was. Her vision was maddeningly blurry. The buzzing sound resolved into an alarm from her suit. Colored lights flashed in her face as the suit's HUD sent her data she couldn't read. It was in the middle of rebooting, and alarms were coming on one by one. She tried to move her arms and found that, although weak, she wasn't paralyzed or frozen in place. The impact gel in her suit had returned to a liquid state. Something moved across the window of faint light that was her helmet's face shield. A head, bobbing in and out of view. Then a click as someone plugged a hard line into her suit's external port. A corpsman, then, downloading her injury data. A voice, male and young, in her suit's internal speakers said, "Gotcha, Gunny. We gotcha. Gonna be okay. Gonna be all right. Just hang in there." He hadn't quite finished saying "there" when she blacked out again. She woke bouncing down a long white tunnel on a stretcher. She wasn't wearing her suit anymore. Bobby was afraid that the battlefield medtechs hadn't wasted time taking her out of it the normal way, that they just hit the override that blew all the seams and joints apart. It was a fast way to get a wounded soldier out of 400 kilos of armored exoskeleton, but the suit was destroyed in the process. Bobby felt a pang of remorse for the loss of her faithful old suit. A moment later, she remembered that her entire platoon had been ripped to pieces before her eyes, and her sadness about the lost suit seemed trivial and demeaning. A hard bump on the stretcher sent a jolt of lightning up her spine and hurled her back into darkness. "Sergeant Draper," a voice said. Bobby tried to open her eyes and found it impossible to do. Each eyelid weighed 1,000 kilos, and even the attempt left her exhausted. So she tried to answer the voice and was surprised and a little ashamed of the drunken mumble that came out instead. "She's conscious, but just barely," the voice said. It was a deep, mellow male voice. It seemed filled with warmth and concern. Bobby hoped that the voice would keep talking until she fell back asleep. A second voice, female and sharp, replied, "Let her rest. Trying to bring her fully awake right now is dangerous." The kind voice said, "I don't care if it kills her, Doctor. I need to speak to this soldier, and I need to do it now. So you give her whatever you need to give her to make that happen." Bobby smiled to herself, not parsing the words the nice voice said, just the kindly, warm tone. It was good to have someone like that to take care of you. She started to fall back asleep, the coming blackness a welcome friend. White fire shot up Bobby's spine, and she sat bolt upright in bed, as awake as she'd ever been. It felt like going on the juice, the chemical cocktail they gave sailors to keep them conscious and alert during high-G maneuvers. Bobby opened her eyes and then slammed them shut again when the room's bright white light nearly burned them out of her sockets. "Turn off the lights," she mumbled, the words coming out of her dry throat in a whisper. The red light seeping in through her closed eyelids dimmed, but when she tried to open them again, it was still too bright. Someone took her hand and held it while a cup was put into it. "Can you hold that?" the nice voice said. Bobby didn't answer. She just brought the cup to her mouth and drank the water in two greedy swallows.
More, she said,
this time in something resembling her old voice. She heard the sounds of someone scooting a chair and then footsteps away from her on a tile floor. Her brief look at the room had told her she was in a hospital. She could hear the electric hum of medical machines nearby, and the smells of antiseptic and urine competed for dominance. Disheartened, she realized she was the source of the urine smell. A faucet ran for a moment, and then the footsteps came toward her. The cup was put back into her hand. She sipped at it this time, letting the water stay in her mouth a while before swallowing. It was cool and delicious. When she was finished, the voice asked,
"More?"
She shook her head.
"Maybe later," she said.
Then, after a moment,
"Am I blind?"
"No. You've been given a combination of focus drugs and powerful amphetamines, which means your eyes are fully dilated. Sorry I didn't think to lower the lights before you woke up." The voice was still filled with kindness and warmth. Bobby wanted to see the face behind that voice, so she risked squinting through one eye. The light didn't burn into her like it had before, but it was still uncomfortable. The owner of the nice voice turned out to be a very tall, thin man in a naval intelligence uniform. His face was narrow and tight, the skull beneath it pressing to get out. He gave her a frightening smile that didn't extend past a slight upturn at the corners of his mouth. "Gunnery Sergeant Roberta W. Draper, 2nd Marine Expeditionary Force," he said, his voice so at odds with his appearance that Bobby felt like she was watching a movie dubbed from a foreign language. After several seconds, he still hadn't continued, so Bobby said,
"Yes, sir,"
then glanced at his bars and added, "Captain." She could open both eyes now without pain, but a strange tingling sensation was moving up her limbs, making them feel numb and shaky at the same time. She resisted an urge to fidget.
"Sergeant Draper, my name is Captain Thorson, and I am here to debrief you. We've lost your entire platoon. There's been a 2-day pitched battle between the United Nations and Martian Congressional Republic forces on Ganymede, which, at most recent tally, has resulted in over 5 billion MCR dollars of infrastructure damage and the deaths of nearly 3,000 military and civilian personnel." He paused again, staring at her through narrowed eyes that glittered like a snake's. Not sure what response he was looking for, Bobby just said,
"Yes, sir."
"Sergeant Draper, why did your platoon fire on and destroy the UN military outpost at Dome 14?
This question was so nonsensical that Bobby's mind spent several seconds trying to figure out what it really meant.
"Who ordered you to commence firing, and why?"
Of course, he couldn't be asking why her people had started the fight. Didn't he know about the monster?
"Don't you know about the monster?"
Captain Thorson didn't move, but the corners of his mouth dropped into a frown and his forehead bunched up over his nose.
"Monster," he said, none of the warmth gone from his voice. "Sir, some kind of monster, mutant, something attacked the UN outpost. The UN troops were running to us to escape it. We didn't fire on them. This whatever it was killed them, and then it killed us," she said, nauseated and pausing to swallow at the lemony taste in her mouth. "I mean, everyone but me."
Thorson frowned for a moment, then reached into one pocket and took out a small digital recorder. He turned it off, then set it on a tray next to Bobby's bed.
"Sergeant, I'm going to give you a second chance. Up to now, your record has been exemplary. You are a fine Marine, one of our best. Would you like to start over?"
He picked up the recorder and placed a finger on the delete button while giving her a knowing look.
"You think I'm lying?" she said. The itchy feeling in her limbs resolved itself into a very real urge to reach out and snap the smug bastard's arm off at the elbow.
"We all shot at it. There will be gun camera footage from the entire platoon of this thing killing UN soldiers and then attacking us, sir."
Thorson shook his hatchet-shaped head at her, narrowing his eyes until they almost disappeared.
"We have no transmissions from the platoon for the entire fight, and no uploaded data."
"They were jamming," Bobby interrupted. "I lost my radio link when I got close to the monster, too."
Thorson continued as though she had not spoken. "And all of the local hardware was lost when an orbital mirror array fell onto the dome. You were outside the impact area, but the shockwave threw you nearly another quarter of a kilometer. It took us some time to find you."
"All of the local hardware was lost." Such a sterile way of putting it.
"Everyone in Bobby's platoon blown into shrapnel and vapor when a couple thousand tons of mirror fell out of orbit onto them." A monitor started sounding a low, chiming alert, but no one else paid it any attention, so she didn't either.
"My suit, sir. I shot at it too. My video will still be there."
"Yes," Thorson said. "We've examined your suit's video log. It's nothing but static."
This is like a bad horror movie, she thought. The heroine who sees the monster, but no one will believe her. She imagined the second act in which she was court-martialed in disgrace and only got her redemption in the third act when the monster showed up again and killed everyone who didn't believe.
"Wait," she said. "What decompression did you use?"
"My suit is an older model. It uses the version 5.1 video compression."
"Tell the tech that and have them try it again."
Thorson stared at her for a few moments, then pulled out his hand terminal and called someone.
"Have Sergeant Draper's combat suit brought up to her room. Send a tech with video gear with it."
He put the terminal away and then gave Bobby another of those frightening smiles.
"Sergeant, I admit that I am extremely curious about what you want me to see. If this is still a ruse of some kind, you've only bought yourself a few more moments."
Bobby didn't reply, but her reaction to Thorson's attitude had finally shifted from frightened, through angry, to annoyed. She pushed herself up in the narrow hospital bed and turned sideways, sitting on the edge and tossing the blanket to the side. With her size, her physical presence up close usually either frightened men or turned them on. Either way, it made them uncomfortable. She leaned toward Thorson a bit and was rewarded when he pushed his chair back an equal amount. She could tell from his disgusted expression that he immediately knew what she'd done, and he looked away from her smile. The door to the room opened, and a pair of Navy techs wheeled in her suit on a rack. It was intact. They hadn't wrecked it, taking her out. She felt a lump come up in her throat and swallowed it back down. She wasn't going to show even a moment's weakness in front of this Thorson clown. The clown pointed at the senior of the two techs and said,
"You, what's your name?"
The young tech snapped off a salute and said, "Petty Officer Electrician's Mate Singh, sir."
"Mr. Singh, Sergeant Draper here is claiming that her suit has a different video compression than the new suits, and that's why you were unable to read her video data. Is this correct?"
Singh slapped himself on the forehead with his palm.
"Shit, yeah," he said. "I didn't think. This is the old Mark III Goliath suit. When they started making the Mark IV, they completely rewrote the firmware. Totally different video storage system. Wow, I feel pretty stupid."
"Yes," interrupted Thorson. "Do whatever you need to do to display the video stored on that suit. The sooner you do, the less time I will have to dwell on the delays caused by incompetence."
Singh, to his credit, did not reply. He immediately plugged the suit into a monitor and began working. Bobby examined her suit. It had a lot of scratches and dings, but appeared otherwise undamaged. She felt a strong urge to go put it on, and then tell Thorson where he could stick his attitude. A new set of shakes moved up her arms and legs. Something fluttered in her neck like the heartbeat of a small animal. She reached up and touched it. It was her pulse. She started to say something, but the tech was pumping his fist and high-fiving his assistant. "Got it, sir," Singh said, then began the playback. Bobby tried to watch, but the picture kept getting fuzzy. She reached for Thorson's arm to get his attention, but missed somehow and just kept tipping forward. "Here we go again," she thought, and there was a brief moment of free fall before the blackness. "God damn it," the sharp voice said. "I goddamn well told you this would happen. This soldier has suffered internal injuries and a nasty concussion. You can't just pump her full of speed and then interrogate her. It's irresponsible. It's fucking criminal." Bobby opened her eyes. She was back in bed. Thorson sat in the chair by her side. A stocky blonde woman in hospital scrubs stood at the foot of her bed, her face flushed and furious. When she saw Bobby was awake, she moved to her side and took her hand. "Sergeant Draper, don't try to move. You took a fall and aggravated some of your injuries. We've got you stabilized, but you need to rest now." The doctor looked up at Thorson as she said it, her face placing exclamation marks after every sentence. Bobby nodded at her, which made her head feel like a bowl of water being carried in shifting gravity. That it didn't hurt probably meant they'd shot her full of every pain medication they had. "Sergeant Draper's assistance was crucial," Thorson said, not a hint of apology in his lovely voice. "Because of it, she may have just saved us from an all-out shooting war with Earth. Risking one's own life so others don't have to is pretty much the definition of Roberta's job." "Don't call me Roberta," Bobby mumbled. "Gunny," Thorson said, "I'm sorry about what happened to your team, but mostly, I'm sorry for not believing you. Thank you for responding with professionalism. We avoided a serious mistake because of it." "Just thought you were an asshole," Bobby said. "That's my job, soldier." Thorson stood up. "Get some rest. We're shipping you out as soon as you're well enough for the trip." "Shipping me out? Back to Mars?" Thorson didn't answer. He nodded to the doctor, then left. The doctor pushed a button on one of the machines near Bobby's bed, and something cool shot into her arm. The lights went out. Gelatin. Why do hospitals always serve gelatin? Bobby desultorily poked her spork at the quivering mound of green on her plate. She was finally feeling good enough to really eat, and the soft and see-through foods they kept bringing her were growing more unsatisfying. Even the high-protein, high-carbohydrate slop they cranked out on most Navy ships sounded good right then. Or a thick mushroom steak, covered in gravy with a side of couscous. The door to her room slid open, and her doctor, who she now knew was named Tricia Pichon, but who insisted that everyone call her Dr. Trish, came in along with Captain Thorson and a new man she didn't know. Thorson gave her his creepy smile, but Bobby had learned that it was just the way the man's face worked. He seemed to lack the muscles necessary for normal smiling. The new man wore a Marine chaplain's uniform of indeterminate religious affiliation. Dr. Trish spoke first. "Good news, Bobby. We're turning you loose tomorrow. How do you feel?" "Fine. Hungry," Bobby said, then gave her gelatin another stab. "We'll see about getting you some real food then," Dr. Trish said, then smiled and left the room. Thorson pointed at the chaplain. "This is Captain Martins. He'll be coming with us on our trip. I'll leave you two to get acquainted." Thorson left before Bobby could respond, and Martins plopped himself down in the chair next to her bed. He stuck out his hand, and she shook it. "Hello, Sergeant," he said. When I marked my 2790 form as none for religious faith, I was serious about that," Bobby said, cutting him off. Martin smiled, apparently not offended by her interruption or her agnosticism. "I'm not here in a religious capacity, Sergeant. I'm also a trained grief counselor, and since you witnessed the death of every person in your unit and were almost killed yourself, Captain Thorson and your doctor agree that you might need me." Bobby started to make a dismissive reply, which was cut off by the lump in her chest. She hid her discomfort by taking a long drink of water, then said, "I'm fine. Thanks for coming by." Martins leaned back in the chair, his smile never wavering. "If you were really all right after what you've been through, it would be a sign that something was wrong. And you're about to be thrown into a situation with a lot of emotional and intellectual pressure. Once we get to Earth, you won't have the luxury of having an emotional breakdown or post-traumatic stress responses. We have a lot of work to..." "Earth?" Bobby pounced on the word. "Wait a minute. Why am I going to Earth?" Chapter 5 Avasarala. Christian Avasarala, assistant to the Undersecretary of Executive Administration, sat near the end of the table. Her sari was orange, the only splash of color in the otherwise military blue and gray of the meeting. The seven others with seats at the table were the heads of their respective branches of the United Nations military forces, all of them men. She knew their names, their career paths and psychological profiles, pay rates and political alliances, and who they were sleeping with. Against the back wall, personal assistants and staff pages stood in uncomfortable stillness like the shy teenagers at a dance. Avasarala snuck a pistachio out of her purse, cracked the shell discreetly, and popped the salted nut into her mouth. "Any meeting with Martian Command is going to have to wait until after the situation on Ganymede is stabilized. Official diplomatic talks before then are only going to make it seem like we've accepted the new status quo." That was Admiral Nguyen, youngest of the men present. Hawkish, impressed with himself in the way that successful young men tended to be. General Adiki Sandoval nodded his bull-wide head. "Agreed. It's not just Mars we need to think about here. If we start looking weak to the Outer Planets Alliance, you can count on a spike in terrorist activity." Michael Agee, from the Diplomatic Corps, leaned back on his chair and licked his lips anxiously. His slicked back hair and pinched face made him look like an anthropomorphic rat. "Gentlemen, I have to disagree." "Of course you do," General Nettleford said dryly. A.G. ignored him. "Meeting with Mars at this point is a necessary first step. If we start throwing around preconditions and obstacles, not only is this process going to take longer, but the chances for renewed hostilities go up. If we can take the pressure off, blow off some steam..." Admiral Nguyen nodded, his face expressionless. When he spoke, his tone was conversational. "You guys over at DIP have any metaphors more recent than the steam engine?" Avasarala chuckled with the others. She didn't think much of AG either. "Mars has already escalated," General Nettleford said. "Seems to me our best move at this point is to pull the seventh back from Ceres Station, get them burning, put a ticking clock on the wall, then see if the Martians want to stand back on Ganymede." "Are you talking about moving them to the Jovian system?" Nguyen asked. "Or are you taking them in toward Mars?" "Taking something in toward Earth looks a lot like taking it in toward Mars," Nettleford said. Avasarala cleared her throat. "Do you have anything new on the initial attacker?" she asked. "The tech guys are working on it," Nettleford said. But that makes my point. If Mars is testing out new technologies on Ganymede, we can't afford to let them control the tempo. We have to get a threat of our own on board. It was the proto-molecule, though? A.G. asked. I mean, it was whatever was on Eros when it went down. Working on that, Nettleford said again, biting at the words a little. There are some gross similarities, but there's some basic differences, too. It didn't spread the way it did on Eros. Ganymede isn't changing the way the population of Eros did. From the satellite imagery we've got, it looks like it went to Martian territory and either self-destructed or was disposed of by their side. If it's related to Eros at all, it's been refined. So Mars got a sample and weaponized it, Admiral Souther said. He didn't talk much. Avasarala always forgot how high his voice was. One possibility, Nettleford said. One very strong possibility. Look, Nguyen said with a self-satisfied little smile, like a child who knew he was going to get his way. I know we've taken first strike off the table here, but we need to talk about what the limits are on immediate response. If this was a dry run for something bigger, waiting may be as good as walking out an airlock. We should take the meeting with Mars, Avasarala said. The room went quiet. Nguyen's face darkened. Is that, he said, but never finished the sentence. Avasarala watched the men look at each other. She took another pistachio from her purse, ate the meat, and tucked the shells away. A.G. tried not to look pleased. She really did need to find out who had pulled strings to have him represent the diplomatic corps. He was a terrible choice. Security's going to be a problem, Nettleford said. We're not letting any of their ships inside our effective defense perimeter.
Well, we can't have it on their terms. If we're going to do this, we want them here, where we control the ground.
Park them a safe distance away and have our transports pick them up? They'll never agree to that.
So let's find out what they will agree to.
Avasarala quietly stood up and headed for the door. Her personal assistant, a European boy named Soren Cotwold, detached himself from the back wall and followed her. The generals pretended not to notice her exit, or maybe they were so wrapped up in the new set of problems she'd handed them they really didn't. Either way, she was sure they were as pleased to have her out as she was to leave. The hallways of the United Nations complex in The Hague were clean and wide. The decor a soft style that made everything look like a museum diorama of Portuguese colonies in the 1940s. She paused at an organics recycling unit and started digging the shells out of her bag.
What's next? She asked. Debriefing with Mr. Ehrenreich.
After that?
Misten Gravis about the Afghanistan problem. Cancel it.
What should I tell him? Avasarala dusted her hands over the waste container, then turned, walking briskly toward the central commons and the elevators.
Fuck him, she said. Tell him the Afghanis have been resisting external rule since before my ancestors were kicking out the British. As soon as I figure out how to change that, I'll let him know.
Yes, ma'am.
I also need an updated summary paper on Venus, the latest. And I don't have time to get another PhD to read it, so if it's not in clear, concise language, fire the son of a bitch and get someone who knows how to write.